David A. Price presents...
Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 306. I'm your host, Steve Raker, in the comic book bunker up in upstate New York, along with WWX Kevin up in Canada. That's right, for the podcast that's up in your face. And as always, we're sponsored by nobody. You think those two things might be related? Perhaps. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, and all the usual places you can catch podcasts and get episode archives over on marvelnoise.com. And here we are again. Andrew's over in China doing every Disney that exists, you know?
Yeah, sadly we are rabbitless. But of course he's still trying to get some of that Marvel, international Marvel flavor in him while he's there too.
Yum. Looking forward to hearing about it and seeing pictures.
This is true. So I don't know what happened, Steve, but I think they might have accidentally sent a box of Marvel Legends to Canada instead of more Thor or something.
What do you mean?
Like I had a weird encounter this week. Because I check out online, it tells me that what I'm calling the Marvel Legends legacy, to pair with the comics, the series, it says online that it's supposed to come out in like December 2017 and everything.
Okay.
And they're here already.
What?
I don't know how often this happens. I'm like, why are these on the shelves at like Toys R Us already? I'm like, this makes no sense.
What I'm not even familiar with what this wave is.
Well, it was weird because I've been like looking for Hela, and all I can find is like massive amounts of Loki. Like, I thought everyone liked him, but they don't buy his toys apparently.
Not movie
I
Loki.
Don't know. Like he's like everywhere. He's like the peg warmer of that wave, and like that wave isn't even that plentiful. I don't know. It's weird.
I found my Hela.
But yeah, this is the wave that's I've seen it listed as like retro or vintage. And the packaging, do you remember this is going way back. I don't know how well you remember this. But you remember Toy Biz in 1990?
In 1990? Like
they put out some Marvel superheroes. Yeah, they put out some Marvel superheroes action figures. Like this is before they even put out like the X-Men, where they did like every X-Men imaginable. Like this was like their first wave, I think, of Marvel figures.
I don't remember that.
Because I distinctly remember this, because we had a toy store called Toy City, and it was only around for a few years before it was like out of business in the mall, and then we didn't have a toy store for many more years after that.
Okay, that sucks.
So I remember going into the store and seeing this wave, and there was like Captain America and Spider-Man and like a bunch of other characters.
What's the scale? How tall were these?
I'm going to say probably 5-inch.
Huh.
They weren't like super poseable or anything. Like this is like really early Toy Biz Marvel stuff. Like, the sculpts aren't very good. They're kind of, like, you know. And then they probably have some, like, action figure feature where it's, like, you know, Captain America's shield shoots or whatever.
This isn't the thing where Andrew got me that Deathlok where you can see in his skull and see his brain, is it?
I think that was later on. But, yeah, that's probably around the early era, yeah. Because the packaging on these new, like, legacy legends is just, like, the packaging back then. Because I know of a lot of other places have done, like the retro packaging, you know, Star Wars or whatever. Even the wrestling, it's like they just say, oh, look, it's the cool retro packaging. And yeah, now they're using it for this.
I like the Kenner old retro Star Wars packaging, man. When I see that, it just brings me right back to being a kid and looking on the shelf.
It looks so weird with the Marvel stuff. Because it's sort of like they had the effects, like, I'm not words they use, but it's sort of like a pow, bam, and they have stars on there, and it's sort of like gray packaging. It's just, it's kind of strange. All right. But they're all characters that have been done before.
So this Deathlok that Andrew got for me is from 1992. It's Toy Biz.
Okay.
92, and you can 92. See his brains, and there's hidden cyber strength inside this Marvel Superheroes Deathlok. But the packaging is fantastic. It's got the correct logo of the character. The Marvel Superheroes is all like this. You know, there's all stars all around. There's, the background has gray toned like panels from comic.
Yeah, I think that's the original packaging, yeah. Because the later ones for, like, Iron Man cartoon or something, they had different specific stuff. Like, it was even more modern by that point.
The neck doesn't articulate, but it's got elbow and knee joints, so I give it credit there.
Well, they couldn't add fur or something to them, I guess.
There was, there was the Fantastic Four, there was Annihilus, there was Spider-Man, Venom, Silver Surfer, oh, there was two different Spider-Men, Deathlok, and then there was a subsequent line of electronic talking action figures that was Spidey, Punisher, Hulk, Venom, Wolverine, Magneto, and Cyclops, and it's the Walt Simonson X-Factor Cyclops with the blue and white.
Oh, what?
And he's got some big old backpack, and it looks like he might have a gun. He's got something in his hand, and he's pointing it out. I can't tell what it is, unless it's perhaps the hand control to the backpack he's wearing. But this picture looks like he's pointing a gun.
Well, they might be in retro packaging, but these are totally like modern, posable figures anyways in this wave.
And the regular 6-inch scale that we're used to?
Yeah, like you get Spider-Man, he's like, I think each one basically comes with a head or something extra. Like the Spider-Man comes, he's like unmasked, sort of, so he could eat a piece of pizza, okay. Which is probably a reuse from some other wave.
Yep.
You have like a Punisher that's sort of like 80s, 90s Jim Lee with like a big rocket launcher, but his alternate head is like a war journal bandana.
As long as he doesn't have the ponytail.
Well, you can't see the back of the head, Steve, so I cannot confirm that. There's like the brown and tan Wolverine costume.
Okay.
Captain America, just like a classic Captain America. Iron Man, it's more like the early 90s, sort of like animated modular armor. If I'm going to get anyone, I'm like, I'm always a fool for Iron Man like figures, because I'm like, it's different again.
Yeah, it makes sense to have a bunch of different versions of the same character on the shelf next to each other when it's Iron Man, right? It's just like having a gallery of his armors.
Yeah. And then Black Widow, who's zipped up this time.
Oh, like
and
the
has
old
a different head sculpt.
Hmm. Interesting.
She has long hair in the black costume.
She can look cool with zipped up when it's all the way zipped up.
Yeah.
You know, like the original.
Oh, I think it's a really nice figure. Yeah.
Like the original Romita design, you know, was pretty cool. And now, yeah. I wonder if that Iron Man is most similar to the Iron Man that they had in the two-pack. That was Iron Man and the Mandarin, or the Mandarin. Because that was that 80s armor.
See, I never got the...
I mean, not 80s armor,
that
90s armor.
I never got that two-pack.
That's a good one. I think that's the only Mandarin. I think that's the only Mandarin that they've made. So that's why I ended up picking that one up.
Really?
I'm pretty sure.
Because I had trouble getting those types of things.
Yeah, there was like a Daredevil and Kingpin one. There was, I can't remember. There was a Wolverine and Sabretooth one. Maybe Hulk and Leader? I can't remember.
Maybe, because I got... I'm not sure if they were the same, but I remember getting, like, a Brood. And what was the other character?
Oh.
Maybe that was a later one.
Yeah, that
they
was...
They did some weird ones with, like...
That was an alien set where it was a Skrull and a Brood, right?
Okay.
Because that's how I got a Brood, because they also
yeah,
had...
Yeah, probably was a Skrull, yeah.
They had a Queen Brood Build-A-Figure once, and I never got all the parts to that, but then I did eventually get a Brood by getting that two-pack with the Skrull. Mm-hmm. The Skrull Brood
combo. Yeah, I
have
two Broods.
they're breeding. They're brooding.
They're brooding. And then I think they have, like, Oh, what was it? Like did they have a Skrull Electra or some weird?
Oh, they probably had a variant, like a San Diego version, maybe, or something.
Okay, so the Iron Man from the Mandarin.
Yeah.
Like it's like the chest piece is different.
Okay.
So it's not like exactly the same, but. It still looks like that era.
Yeah, so it is similar then.
Yeah, because it has like a circular chest, it still looks like a clunky boxes, but it's not the exact same design.
It's hard because that's when Romita Jr. was starting to really come into his own style, and when he added that clunkiness, I mean he made it look cool, you know, on Iron Man, especially with. You know, when Leighton's doing inks and stuff, but yeah.
And of course the stars thing on the vintage is boot thrusters.
Sweet.
But they get you of course you get two of the things so it looks like he's blasting.
I do like my boot roller skates though.
They should that would have been nice.
Right?
Popo roller skates. And a word balloon where he's saying, "Oh, the plexiglass is pretty good on my." Is that like the 70s, 80s equivalent to transistors? Where he starts talking about his plexiglass on his armor, and you're like, "Ooh,
my silicon!"
Like you wonder about that now. I'm going. I hope you have better than plexiglass on your suit there. Well, that's what he looks through, right? Isn't that what he comments?
I'm sure. It just gets thicker and thicker every mock wave.
Yeah.
And did you know that Andrew also? I mean, we're talking about him more than when he's on the show, but he sent me a Human Torch Marvel Legends figure, the new Walmart or not Walmart, Walgreens, one of them Walls exclusive. Yeah. Walgreens has that exclusive deal with. The Marvel Legends, where they're doing a Fantastic Four related wave, and the first one was Namor, and then they did Sue with Herbie, and now they did a Human Torch, and it's quite different than the other Human Torches they've done, and so that was cool.
I have three torches, though. I'm like, do I really need another torch? I'm like, well...
Ooh, well, now I have three torches, so which torch do you have that I don't? Do you have one where he's, like, partially... burning and you can see his regular face?
Yeah, I think I have something like that.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I skipped that.
Because I think I was really... It's sort of like the Invisible Woman when they have the, like, semi... Like, you know, it doesn't really matter that's a movie one. I just, like, right. Sort of like ones like that. I'm just like, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, when the toy stores were clearing out of those Fantastic Four movie... figures when the movie bombed too, you know, and it was time to clear the shelves for the next movie. They had those 6-inch figures for like $3 clearance. I got a regular, even though the Sue was based on Jessica Alba, there was no Marvel Legends Invisible Woman to that point. So I got a regular one, one where she was like partially phased, just like her hands and kind of like her calves and feet, and then one where she was completely clear. It was like, and all for like less than $10.
Well, they did so, for that movie, they did so many rotocast big figures. It was like Johnny not flamed, partly flamed, fully flamed, and like with Sue, and I was just like, wow, how many different figures did they do? Like, they did every variant you can imagine.
Now you can use the fan. You can use.
But I think I got.
So you could use the Human Torch from that line, the partially flamed one, now to be Captain America burning, because it was the same actor.
I guess so. But I think I got that box set for the Fantastic Four that had all four of them, because I'm trying to remember where I got, because it's a Waringo Sue.
Yeah, that was much later, though.
Yeah, I think that's probably the first time that. Maybe the first time I got? I don't know. Since he wasn't in, like, the regular stuff. But I need I think what's coming up of the Submariner with, where he's just in a Speedo.
Oh.
So I already have him in the...
With the black.
You know, the fancy black clothing, so.
Yeah, I have an old Speedo version of him, I think. I'm looking because some of them have tipped over, so I don't have a good vantage point from here. I'm sitting below them.
As long as they're not shelf diving.
I'm too lazy to stand. Look over my shoulder.
Yeah.
Speaking of too lazy to stand and look over his shoulder on the way out the door, big news this past week, huh? With Bendis leaving Marvel?
Yes, it's kind of crazy. I'm sure you could pull a quote from me saying, well, he's pretty enmeshed at Marvel. He's never going to be leaving that place. Like, he's in their movies, he's in their comics, their animation.
But was he anymore? You know what I mean? I think that's got to be a big part of it when that whole creative committee
ended. Still, yeah, but isn't he still, like, involved on some level, like in the Jessica Jones, like
the TV stuff.
Like, I don't mean he's actively involved, but yeah.
No, the TV stuff, yeah, but the movie stuff they got pretty cut out of, you know.
Yeah,
I gotta think it's gotta be about the more than comics prospects over at DC of whatever deal he got. Don't you think?
I don't know, because. Does DC care about that stuff yet?
Hmm.
I don't know. Like, they're like, oh, our movies made a lot of money, and it was, and people didn't like them as well as the Marvel things, so who cares? We're still making money. Like, isn't that enough? Like,
yeah, but don't you?
I don't know. But then they made Wonder Woman, who people like. But people like that one better. So what? So maybe I don't know.
But don't you think that, like, the the fact that he does come from the more successful team, so to speak, gives him probably more cachet than he actually carries, or that they maybe that they'll even utilize.
Maybe, but I think it would have been more shocking if he would have left Marvel like at his height. Like, I'm not saying he's a has-been right now. Like, he still writes a lot of books and everything. No, but
fair enough.
Like, after 17 years, it's sort of like. Yeah, you're like, oh, he's leaving. Like, it's still big news, but you're sort of like, oh, he's been there a long time. Like, you're not like waiting, like, oh, I really wanted to hear that run on whatever. But you know, he's done just about everything.
It's been a long while since a Bendis book has generated excitement. I mean, somewhere around the end of his New Avengers run, it seemed like kind of the fan buzz for his work was kind of waning. And then Age of Ultron right after that, I don't think helped much because that was a pretty weird little event, you know?
Did he ever write a great event, though? Like, I don't think so.
House of M, Secret Invasion, Age of Ultron, Civil War 2, some of AVX, and Siege.
That's a terrible track record.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe I'll give him Siege. That Siege was good and short. All right. Maybe I'll give him Siege, okay.
And I mean, and he did a lot of work in the Ultimate Universe. Ultimate Spider-Man,
yeah.
Ultimate Marvel Team-Up, Ultimate X-Men. Actually, I like that run that was with him and Finch. Ultimate Fantastic Four he launched with Mark Miller, the first six issues.
Yeah.
He did like the Ultimate Power, Ultimate Origins, Ultimate Enemy, Ultimate Mystery, Ultimate Doom, Ultimate End, and the Cataclysm, Ultimate's Last Stand, like all those like minis too.
Yeah.
Then like in the 616, he did Daredevil, Elektra, Alias, All New X-Men, and Uncanny X-Men. That Secret War mini, the one with the Del Otto painting.
There Pulse. Was a big gap in the middle.
Yeah, there was. The Pulse, Avengers, where he disassembled them, and then they made New Avengers, and Mighty Avengers, and Dark Avengers. Then there was the Spider-Woman stuff. He did the Spider-Woman origin mini with the Luna Brothers, and then did that Alex Maleev, what was it, seven-issue miniseries that they made into
Ocean
the first
comic.
One of those. Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
And then Moon Knight with Maleev also, right? That was 12 issues?
Yeah.
Then Guardians of the Galaxy and Iron Man and...
And Defenders.
Yeah.
And X-Men.
And Jessica
and
Jones.
Another X-Men. Exactly. Well, it's funny that I feel like I was sort of coming back to some of his more recent stuff. Like, I think there was a long gap in the middle where I didn't read anything by him, really. Like, I think after he did, like, the five-page zoom-in on the planet Earth with no dialogue in New Avengers, I was like, I'm out. And that was probably, the second year? And he was on that book for I don't know how many years. So I was relatively early, and then I didn't really read anything by him. And then I thought his X-Men was better than his Avengers. And then I was trying out Defenders right now. So I guess I kind of came back at the end when he's leaving.
I kind of was more of a fan of his presence overall at the company. I think his value was probably felt more like at these retreats and things when he's helping shape story and bouncing ideas and almost like a writer room type of behavior from him. But again, like the specifics, again, like you said, the last bunch of years, it's not like you're, even though he's their top writer, you would say, it doesn't feel like he's putting out the top books. But he's done a lot there, so I mean, good luck to him. I hope that Marvel doesn't find that they were overly relying on him.
Yeah. But he was definitely a huge important factor in reviving Marvel in the early 2000s.
No question.
And I was reading like all his stuff at that point.
And and his stuff at the retreats, I think that's I mean his being the company guy, I think was where his strength was, and if he wasn't feeling it anymore, then more power to him. May he fare better than Bagley and John Romita Jr. did when they have jumped to DC.
Ooh. Well, I was just thinking, remember when Geoff Johns came over to Marvel? And that never really felt right. So I'm hoping like when Bendis goes over, like he doesn't have that kind of like awkward thing going on.
I like Geoff Johns' Kang story, but the art was not consistent and it wasn't top tier, in my opinion. And so that really made me lose my enthusiasm for what he was doing. But, no, so that's interesting anyway.
Well, then who's next? It seems like some guys are like, oh, who's going to be the next, like, up-and-comer or the big, you know what I mean? That's like, some of the guys, like, just, it seems like they come from the indie books and you're almost there, like, right away. Like, I think of Hickman, there's almost no lead-up to his, like, I'm taking over the Avengers and writing all the awesome stories.
Yeah, well, the lead-up was Fantastic Four. to something, you know?
Well, yeah, but like he didn't do a whole lot of books.
True. But I think that Marvel had a lot of eggs in the Bendis basket. I mean, I think it would be smart for them not to necessarily replace him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But rather spread what he was over, you know, several different editorial offices.
Like, I know who, like, the people I look for now that are new creators, but some of those titles just didn't take off. Like I always, we always brought up Unstoppable Wasp. I'm like, I'll try anything from that writer, so.
I can't remember what podcast it was I was listening to. It might have been the Comic Conspiracy, but they were, you know, sort of in a backhanded way saying, who's going to take up the slack in writing all these books that Bendis writes? And they were saying, oh, just make, you know, give more to Jerry Duggan. He's already writing everything, that kind of thing. It's like, but, you know, Duggan's writing good stuff, though. I wouldn't mind that.
Yeah, but I don't know. Like, I wouldn't mind, like, a Fred Van Lente, another book by him, or, like, Jeff Parker doing a book. But those are never, like, the go-to guys.
Right.
There always seems to be, like, mid-level, but, like, sometimes I, like, really enjoy their books. Or, like with Hawkeye, like, Kelly Thompson, like, I really enjoy her writing, but, you know, I don't know who's... Or like the Defenders, I was hoping that David Walker would be like writing Defenders, and then Bendis was writing it, and I'm like, all right, I guess I'll try it out.
You know, in thinking of DC with Bendis's destination being there, I was just thinking about like Marvel's allegories to the DC. Like Justice League characters, and not just the Squadron Supreme, because, well, of course, the Squadron Supreme is the obvious ones, right? But that was satire, and years later, there have been characters that have developed into those similar roles or at least similar power sets as the main Justice League, anyway. Like outside of the Squadron Supreme, and the Squadron Supreme, it was the JLA. From like another universe in the Avengers back in 70. I want to say it's a 1970 Avengers 85. They were Earth S, and you know, there was Superman was Hyperion, and Batman was Nighthawk, and Wonder Woman was Power Princess, and Flash was the Wizard, and then Speed Demon after that. And then Green Lantern was Dr. Spectrum. I think I was thinking of it because I was thinking of Nova, that like Nova is, you know, Marvel's Green Lantern in a lot of ways, right? I mean, he had the same MO by being part of the intergalactic core of, you know, militia or whatever. So, although Dr. Spectrum is the more really derivative with having a light power ring, but yet Nova is has sort of become Marvel's Green Lantern. You get where I'm going? Then, like,
yeah, it's sort of Spider-Man Green Lantern.
You're right, exactly. Well, that's what they said right on the cover of Nova number one in the tradition of Spider-Man. Then for Superman, obviously, there's Hyperion, but then there's also been, like, the Shi'ar Gladiator in his red and blue with the same power set as Superman was always used as the Superman allegory. And then they went really obvious by making the Century, right? Having it retconned in. And for Batman... even though Nighthawk came over to the 616, you know, Moon Knight really has that similar MO, and a lot of people make those comparisons.
The Daredevil, Batman. If he goes on a Batman book, it'll be too obvious.
And then the Flash, that's the toughest one because of the Flash actually having that cool aspect of being a police, you know, criminal scientist, that kind of guy. But certainly power set this.
So Quicksilver's never showed that kind of interest?
Yeah, or the Eternals, Makari. And then lastly, Wonder Woman. I mean, there's been in the 70s, Thundra was very much Wonder Woman, you know, the Amazon. Big, strong type. But nowadays, with the, like, the Warrior aspect being so prominent. Maybe like kind of like Angela is even kind of Wonder Woman-y.
I was wondering if you would ever go for like She-Hulk or someone like that.
Yeah, she'd make a good Wonder Woman, huh? Remember when remember when they did the Marvel versus DC and they did the amalgam thing and they had Wonder Woman and what combination was it? Was it Wonder Woman and Storm? I think it was, right? Amazon?
So? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. That was cool. All right.
That's a decent combo.
Enough DC. This is Marvel Noise. This is Marvel Noise. Hey, have you seen the collected editions for this month's previews? There's a lot of good collected editions and of old material.
Well, it was bound to happen eventually. Like,
I gotta say though, of the more recent stuff, it's funny, they have a collection, like a $40 oversized hardcover collection of that Marvel Legacy Point One, with all of those primer pages, like those little origin retellings, all put in there too, and that's the collection. Crazy,
doesn't it remind you of like some other like modern collections where like they put the one issue and then they try to put as many extras or black and white pages or whatever to fill it out as they can.
Totally.
Oh, we're gonna put all the handbooks in here, and then you're like, okay,
yep,
like not the best value or anything.
More back matter than front matter.
Yeah.
Two Marvel Masterworks, a Marvel team up. That it's still not to the real good stuff. It's 23-30, and a Defenders issues 42-57. These are pretty good. It's the ones where Doctor Strange goes bad, where he's the Red Raja, and it's got the Zodiac. The Zodiac versus the Defenders is always good.
You know my Defenders knowledge is like really lacking.
Oh, nutty Valkyrie continuity. It's all here. A couple of omnibuses. There's a Punisher Max Garth Ennis omnibus. The first 30 issues of that. That's a pretty good collection, I think.
I'm thinking this is because after everyone watches the Netflix, they'll want this.
Yeah, yeah. And a Carnage omnibus, which is interesting. It's got all of his non-Spidey appearances all the way through this recent 2016 horror series.
Well, I can tell you, Steve, Carnage sells.
That's right. That's if there's
I've experienced the Carnage phenomenon personally.
If there's one thing we've learned in 2017, it's that Carnage sells. Hey, what's with all the New Mutants books?
What? Seriously?
There's like a complete Zeb Wells New Mutants trade, and there's a complete back to school New Mutants collection that was like when the New Mutants started their own school.
Yeah, the Marvel's never gonna miss an opportunity to cash in on some media tie-in.
Well, is there? What's the tie-in? Is there a New Mutants thing happening?
Yeah, New Mutants movie.
Oh, yeah.
There was a trailer where it was. I think they said, we're not making a superhero movie, we're making a horror movie. But since it's like not Marvel Studios, you're kind of like, I hope this goes over well.
If not, it might be Marvel Studios soon.
Exactly.
Did you hear that talk of Marvel maybe buying a bunch of the Fox movie stuff and everything?
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I know everyone's excited, like the X-Men or Wolverine in the Avengers, and I'm like really, I don't really care about that stuff. Like, I feel like there's been many X-Men movies. Yeah, of course I want to see the perfect X-Men movie, but if you're going to say, oh, who would you add to Marvel, or who would you add to, like, Infinity War or something?
Fantastic
Four. Of course
Four.
I'm going to go with the Fantastic Four.
Yeah. But you know what? With the X-Men movies sort of running their course with the kind of continuity in the style that they've told them and everything, it would be a really easy way for them to start over with a new cast and a new look and a new everything. You know what I mean?
I know, but it's so funny. The X-Men movies have retcons in them and all these alternate things just like the comics.
Yeah.
It had to happen, I guess.
There was even a New Mutants Epic Collection that does 71 through 85 around the Valkyries stuff where, you know, Moonstar's a Valkyrie and all that.
I'm going to have to get that because I started getting rid of my trades and I'm replacing them with the Epic Collections. So
there's some good Epic Collections this month.
I'm jumping in.
There's Iron Man that does, it's called Doom. It's the volume 15, so it's 245 through 257, and it's got the what would be the third Doom Iron Man Bob Layton story, and this one where they're in future Camelot. You know, it's always Camelot when it's Doom and Iron Man together.
Yeah, I've never read this one, but I don't know if I've ever owned that issue either. Probably not. But I've read some stuff around here. And of course, I'm all in on getting all these Iron Mans.
It's got the Axe of Vengeance and Atlantis Attack stuff in there. Tony was paralyzed at the time. It was a weird era, but some good Bob Layton stuff. And David Michelinie again. It's like they tried to recap.
Can we throw in here?
Hey! Working for Tony. And there's a Daredevil Epic Collection. It's volume 2, so it's early stuff. 22 to 41.
This is stuff I've read. This is the awesome, in quotes, I guess, say, Mike Murdock stuff.
Yep. And it's got the crazy Daredevil Doom body swap story.
Oh, jeez. The one thing I'll say is, I don't think it's boring. It's just really weird.
Well, I like one piece of this that I like that kind of continued on is I always like when Kazar is in Daredevil, though, because Kazar needs, you know, he's not a refined, he needs someone to guide him in the ways of the laws of civilized man.
Like, you can't have a saber-toothed tiger just roaming around and doing whatever it wants, I guess, you know. They might not look well on stuff like that.
And the last Epic Collection is Excalibur Volume 2, also Volume 2. That's issues 12 to 30, which unfortunately is the cross-time caper.
Do I need Excalibur, though? I don't know. Like, I have a few of the classic trades, and I'm just like, I don't know. I'm still like...
The first volume would be good, but the Cross Time Caper, I mean, when it started coming out on the stands, Kevin, I felt like it really took the steam out of the series. It was like everyone was excited for the series, cool stuff, new team, Alan Davis, and then all of a sudden they got into this long, I don't know how many parts it was, but I think more than double digits parts, and it was just, there was lots of fill-in artists. Over the 19 issues in this collection, there are 8 different pencilers.
Yikes.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's there's an Avengers Academy complete. That's cool.
Yeah. I enjoyed that series.
Oh, and here's a weird sleeper, is the Captain America, The Adventures of Captain America. It's written by Fabian Nicieza and Carl Kessel, with art by Kevin Maguire and Kevin West.
You know, I found this several years back, like all the individual, like prestige format things. So I have this. Never read it, though.
The cover of the first one is even like bumpy, I think. It's a retro World War II stories of Captain America and Bucky told very stylistically, and it would have been nice if Maguire finished the series, but Kevin West did a nice job on it. The problem, though, is it's right after Marvel got the Malibu coloring, and it's It's grotesque.
Oh.
It's grotesquely colored.
So oh, no.
I wonder if they're going to fix it or not. I don't know. I'm curious.
Yeah, like, you could recolor it, couldn't you?
You almost have to, dude.
Yeah.
If my memory serves me correctly.
Man, there's such weird air stuff like that, where you're getting the lens flare, or they're like, hey, let's put a graphic behind this text. You can read that, right? And you're like, no, stop.
Totally.
It's like the Marvel magazine. It wasn't... Oh, what were they called? Marvel Vision?
Yes.
Some of those were, like, really bad. Like, the graphic design, and they're trying everything on the page.
Ugh, those were awful. I saw that you posted the other day a picture of the Swarm first appearance back in the Champions, issue 14 and 15 from back in the late 70s. What's the story? Did you get those issues or something?
I did. I got them for $2 a piece.
Oh, nice.
And they're not in or anything. But, yeah, I set up last year at the first year of this show out of town that's relatively close. And this year I didn't set up, but I knew someone there was going to have a lot of comics. Cause that's their hometown, and they set up here, and you know, I set up there type of thing, so you get to know, like, who the comic people are and everything.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
He didn't have this thing. Like, I knew he was going to have, like, I knew this guy was going to have, like, good stuff. But anyways, I go there, and there's this totally separate guy, because I thought there would only be one comic booth. This totally separate guy that had, like, retro video games. He had one box of comics, and they were, like, bagged and boarded, and they were $5 each. But beside that were just, like, piles and piles of comics from the 70s to the 90s, unbagged, unboarded, just sitting there, and you had to sort of, like, shift the pile over to get through all the stuff. And, like, none of it was mint, and, like, some of it was, like, really questionable. But some of it, you know, it's like, I guess you would say, like, maybe fine, very fine, type, like, good reader's copies, and even sometimes better than probably reader's copies. So I was going through there, and yeah, they had some Champions, like some What If, stuff like Darkhawk. Of course, I had to buy the first issue. you know, just random stuff, really. But yes, I usually tried to buy the older stuff, because that's nice to find like that, and $2 each, so. I can't pass up Swarm, like, come on.
Yeah, I that's like one of my favorite little two-parters that I'm fond of as a kid, was that, I mean, written by Mantlow with art by Byrne and Esposito, I think, inking them, but it's so cool. It's like they encounter big giant robot bees, and I still don't understand why there's big giant robot bees. Like, all after decades revisiting this story every once in a while, I still don't get the robot bees. But the Swarm, it's his first appearance. He's a Nazi toxicologist who was studying bees, and then the bees, like, surrounded him and enveloped him and everything, and then he's, like, controlling the bees. But Interpool encases the queen bee in a, like, in amber, and somehow it ends up, like, in the Iceman's back pocket or something, how it's, like, in their headquarters, and all the bees are attacking the Champion's headquarters and everything. So awesome.
This is, like, I consider this, like, comics at their finest. Like, creating a villain like that, I'm like, that is just genius. Like, it might not be, like, the best villain or, like, the best story or anything, but that's something that makes me think of superhero comics.
Like, do you think that they had it be robot giant bees so that, it didn't seem so horrific when Hercules, like, ripped their heads off and stuff?
Probably, but I don't know.
In the end, I love the twist at the end, because Hercules, I could picture it. I could picture the panel now. Hercules takes the queen bee, who had mutated to a large size, and chucks her out into the, you know, into the Atlantic Ocean as far as he can hurl her. And all the bees take off from the swarm's body to go follow the queen bee. And it shows that he was nothing but a skeleton that was animated by the bees underneath. And the last panel is the close-up of that skeleton with the one bee crawling out of his eye orbit. Oh, that's awesome.
And that Spider-Man cover from, like, years later where, like, he's, like, getting stung by all the bees.
Uh-huh. I love those.
It's just like, yeah, there's something about it. And then he was also in the cartoon. So if I would have saw that cartoon as a kid, I would have probably been like, oh, yeah, Swarm is awesome. And he says his name weird.
Well, every
And then in that Thunderbolts issue, he says his name like that again.
Every subsequent appearance of the Swarm, I was always thought it was cool because it's like, that's that guy from that Champions story.
Yeah. Man, the Champions was a weird book, too. And then didn't they go up against Godzilla or something, too?
Well, how weird are they? I mean, their weirdness alone can be boiled down to Ghost Rider with eyeballs. hanging out with some of the X-Men and Hercules and the Black Widow thrown in for fun. And Darkstar from the Soviet super soldiers. Craziness.
Oh, boy.
The series that I wanted to catch up with you about, because it's been a while since we talked, is Slot Spider-Man.
Does this fit into the slot?
But
that was pretty bad.
The last few arcs of this book, I think, have been really entertaining and really fast-paced. I was fortunate enough to read them in chunks rather than waiting, you know, in installments. And, man, what a ride.
You know, I took a break after that clone conspiracy? That's what it was, right?
Yeah.
Like, I was still buying them, but yeah, I chunked it after that, because I kind of felt like, I'm like, okay, I think I need a break after that story. Like, this is another one of those situations where I'm like, if Slott left the book, I would be like, you've been on the book a long time, that's cool, you know? Like, I don't feel like there's any stories that I need him to tell, but I also don't want him to leave the book and then some writer come on that I don't know and go, ugh, why did I want him to leave? You know what I mean? Like, it's good stories.
It's like Bendis leaving Marvel.
Yeah. It is like...
Now Slott has Stuart Immonen and Von Grobadger as the art team. Didn't Immonen draw Spider-Man?
Well, that certainly helps.
During JMS's run some, too?
Yeah, he probably did, didn't he?
I think he might have. But it looks great.
Yeah.
Great storytelling, and the coloring really lends itself to the line work. They leave room for some of the flat colors and some of the blends and stuff, even. I think they really do a nice job visually. This book is really sharp. And with Alex Ross covers, that doesn't hurt.
Yeah, he's been doing covers for probably since the first one, right? It seems like he's been, like, every month. Like they really want those covers on these books.
The first arc I wanted to go over with you a little bit is the four-part Osborn Identity, which is issues 25 through 28. And it answers the question of where Osborn's been, right? I mean, he has set himself up in Simcaria with the Baroness. I mean, the Countess. And he's like selling weapons on the black market, which is funny because Spider-Man's now the owner of, you know, a worldwide cutting edge tech company, and he learns of Osborn's activities. And between the two of them, they're basically Tony Stark, you know, like the current wannabe and the former wannabe.
Yeah.
So Parker Industries ends up bankrolling the Silver Sable, who we thought was dead, and S.H.I.E.L.D. doesn't want them to go into some Caria and invading a foreign land and all that stuff, but Peter basically helps Silver Sable, you know, retake some Caria.
Yeah, I'm glad we get some Silver Sable back doing something again.
She looks great, too, with this art team. They know how to make her silver look cool. And what's the Norman aspect is weird here, too. I mean, he's been goaded by Spidey to change his appearance. It goes wrong. He gets facial surgery, and he basically becomes the Joker. I mean, the Goblin, yeah. You know? He's the Goblin, but he's just not green.
Kind of one of those weird situations like that, like, not like Doctor Doom exactly, but one of those, or the Red Skull, but, you know, one of those classic, like, oh, yeah, the villain messes up his face.
Yeah. I was thinking, though, so much for Diodato's Tommy Lee Jones, Norman. It wrote it right into the story. There's also, because he's making weapons out of Simcaria, I love the panels of the Simcarian, like, guard on patrol, and they're all flying around on goblin gliders. And they don't even bother to change the head on the goblin gliders. It's even a little goblin there. Like, it's funny.
Isn't that sort of like Hammer and Shield? They're just like, well, let's exchange one thing for another.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
So Spidey and Silver Sable and company invade Simcaria, and Mockingbird, like, defects from S.H.I.E.L.D. and joins in, too, which is cool. I like her in this book.
Yeah, that seems like something like a long, long-term plotting idea there.
She's becoming like the new Black Cat, since the Black Cat has sort of changed her character around, or how they're using her.
Yeah, less evil, though.
I just mean as being another super-powered babe who seems like way above, you know, Peter's pay scale, but yet he's able to do adventure stuff with, too, you know? And in some ways, she's better than him.
Yeah, well,
In the field, at least.
Well, she's an Avenger.
Yeah, and S.H.I.E.L.D. trained.
I don't know, maybe next issue they'll be in a hot tub, and then they'll be getting married or something.
Yeah. In Shea Stadium.
And then Hawkeye will be like, what?
Goblin's big deal here is he's got a bomb that he's going to set off that's going to turn all of the population of Simcaria into goblins, like with a goblin gas. I told you he was like the Joker. And we get Mockingbird handling the missiles, Sable sword fighting with the Countess for her kingdom, and the best is the Spidey fighting Norman one-on-one without any powers or gadgetry. And it's just a good smackdown. Verbally, too. Of course, Simcaria gets saved and everything, and Silver Sable gets reinstalled as the leader, and Norman escapes. Which brings us to the next arc, which is the three-part Secret Empire crossover in issues 29 to 31. And just after Spidey gets this big confrontation with Norman and this big slug fest with, like, his greatest foe, it happens again. No time to catch your breath, because now he's going to have a big slug down with his greatest foe, Dr. Octopus. It's awesome.
Yeah, I think I enjoyed this one more, but that's because, like, it's built on, like, superior foes and the head swap and, like, all that stuff of, like, well, you didn't really invent your tech. I invented your tech and your body and all that macho head games.
So awesome. It was a great event tie-in because the event really provided cover for Doc Ock to come in and take out Parker Industries on Hydra's behalf. but Ock really wants to, instead of taking it out, wants to take it over. Things have been going well for...
What I thought was... What about the logo? When the logo switches and you're like, what?
Totally. Totally.
I'm just like, who thought of that? Like, that is like the... When the new X-Men, they said, no, look, the letters are, like, mirrored. It's like one of those situations you're like, oh, man.
Yeah, Ock flips off the... Well, flips a switch and the Parker logo, like, the circles that were in the background of the Parker logo come to the forefront to be Otto Octavius. Totally cool. But, you know, things have been going so well for Peter Starker that they had to tear it down. And that's what this is all about. Doc Ock is behind the effort here, and Peter doesn't know that Ock is in a clone of his own body, which, even though he's got the same powers and everything, it's a little suggestive. The clues are there, but it reminds me a lot of the Red Skull taking a clone of Steve Rogers' body, right, in the 80s there.
Yeah. But, totally.
Like you said, Ock is staking claim to Parker Industries. He launched it in Peter's body, after all. He manipulated markets in Parker Industries' favor as the living brain. And he points out that the webware is all derivative of, like, the wristbands and communication devices that they used when they were doing their Web Warriors thing for the whole, Spider-Verse event.
Yeah.
Totally cool. They just keep trying to one-up each other, verbally and in actions. Spidey makes his last stand in Shanghai, where all of the Parker Industry research data is stored that Doc Ock wants. And Spidey makes a good line, too, of, you know, you're the one who created the sinister 6-on-1 odds. How does it feel to have the same thing happen to you? And he calls forth, like, his team of pilots that are all in, like, Spider Slayer robots. That was cool.
Spider-Mobiles.
Yeah, they're all fighting sideways on the side of the building, too.
It's pretty neat.
And the upper hand keeps going back and forth. Ock has a backdoor kill switch that shuts off all of Parker's tech. But Parker has a kill switch that shuts off Ock's, like, tech frequency, so he loses control of his arms and stuff. And then it's just back and forth, until Peter does the ultimate, like, burns the house down behind him, basically, and has all his employees destroy all of their research so that Ock can't get it. And, of course, Ock escapes in the end, but they're, like, you know, Peter, I guess by doing it this way, it's a sacrifice, which is important for the whole Parker motif, right?
Yeah, but the thing is, though, it's like, when he's on his own making sacrifices, you're just like, okay. But, like, he sacrificed all these other people's, like, livelihood and everything, and you're kind of like, ooh.
I thought it was cool, though, how they had him going around beforehand and saying, like, listen, here's the deal. Like, they show him setting up the plan some and saying, listen, your research, you know, they show a little bit of the employees having an opportunity to understand what's going on. And some of the guys, like, hey, listen, they're with him. Like, you helped me get my cancer research farther than ever before. You know, I understand if we have to trash it because the bad guys are coming, we got to do it. And they do. They all destroy it and everything, it showed the loyalty of, like, if you're kind of loyal to your employees, that they can be loyal to you too, kind of thing in a pinch. And it took the Holy Grail out of Ock's hand right when he was close to achieving it. Then issue 32 is a great little palate cleanser, I thought.
Well, this is a strange issue, and I'm going to ask you, what am I saying probably?
I'll probably answer you.
Maybe it's the weirdness of this issue seeping in. Like, you knew something was up with this issue, right? like there's just some, it's just, I don't, maybe it's the artwork too. There's, like, something really surreal about what's going on. It's like an old Doctor Strange story, like, or like an old Marvel 60s story, and you keep on going, really? Really? This is going to happen? Like, what?
Dude, the passage of time in this issue was pun intended, an issue for me.
Yeah.
All the way through the story until the punchline twist at the end, and then it was okay. But I was yes, I was uneasy reading this whole thing. It has a guest art from Greg Smallwood, who, I mean, I like him better on Moon Knight, but
yeah,
it added to the surrealness, and he did the monks great. In this one-off issue, we've got, first of all, this really reminded me a lot of the whole Gathering of the Five and the final chapter arcs that ended the first volumes of Amazing Spider-Man and Peter Parker Spider-Man back in 98, I want to say. It was the Mackie Byrne reboot happened right after that.
That wasn't a good time.
But it was an interesting story because they had just brought back Norman as the Deus Ex Machina for the Clone Saga, right?
Yeah.
But he's depowered. So he's trying to become the Goblin again because he's just Norman. And there was a path for him to get power through this ritual. If you get these objects and you do the ritual, and it's like a crapshoot. You don't know what enhancement you're going to receive from the ritual, but all of them are good except for one. There's power, intelligence, stealth, and then madness, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, that's the one Osborn ends up getting at the end of that. That's what he scores, is the madness. Now here we've got Norman. He's in the same place. He's in search of a method to release the Goblin persona from its nanite suppressed state. Conventional methods aren't working, but as we've seen happen in the past, if you go to the right place, you end up hearing about this Tibetan temple with no name, right?
Yeah, and I'm like, which one is this?
Yeah. He seeks it out. He climbs the mountain. He does the whole deal, right? He meets the priests. They're awesome. They're portrayed very, as you would expect.
But it seems like a 60s Marvel story in a way, too.
Things haven't changed, you know? The image creators hadn't touched them in the 90s, so they've been left untouched.
Exactly.
So they test his potential to be a master of the mystic arts and proceed to teach him the mystic arts. He trains, he learns, he develops. This is where the passage of time starts bothering me. I'm like, he's learning this all way too quick. I'm not going to spoil the twist ending, but...
It seems very much how comics used to... Yeah, how they would use the passage of time, where they didn't care back then. You know what I mean? It's just like, oh well, this happened.
Yeah, because as it's proceeding, you're in a position where you're like, all right, I'm going to forgive the passage of time thing because this is going cool. How he gets trained, he has an opportunity, he has this universal truth visitation about his self potential. And he gets to choose the avatar, his totem, if you will. And he picks the Goblin over the totem that visited him in his vision, saying I know I'm going to be in control. I'm not listening to the universe. And then the monks end up teaming up with Spider-Man to defeat him. That's just a very loose way of not spoiling what happens at the end. So it's like, okay, I could accept that as a little formulaic thing, but what happens is even better.
Yeah. I know.
It's a good done in one, though, and it was nice to see the rug get pulled out from under Norman.
Yeah. Because I'm like, there's a way to do this, and I'm thinking, Slott has a way of doing that, though, where he's like, is he going? And you're like, no. If this is going to be, and then you're like, you know, it goes where it goes.
So that issue 32 is the last issue of the old numbering, and now we're into the legacy numbering with 789 and beyond with the new arc Fall of Parker. And as I read the first couple of issues of this, it's not I'm like, fall of Parker, how can he fall anymore? Like, you know, at least let him have Mockingbird, right? And fortunately, it seems like fall of Parker isn't so much a tight little arc where something even worse happens to him. At least I hope it's not over yet. But it seems like maybe it's like just the new status quo, almost like a Dark Reign or an Age of Heroes or whatever. You know what I mean? It seems like the fall has happened already, and now it's just the fallen Parker.
Yeah, and it's almost just catching up with like all the different supporting cast members and having a lot of fun with that stuff.
Well, you know, you fly too close to the sun and the wings melt, and then you got to go back with your tail between your legs. And now he's got to find how to reestablish himself amongst how to make a living.
And well, he's almost too lazy.
True. He deserves it, though. He deserves a little time to sulk. But good stuff from Slott. I really like the full circle confrontation with Doc Ock. I thought that was great. The verbal stuff, the Hydra, Ock. Yeah, Ock has really been handled so well under Slott, and so many different times and ways too. He's gone back to Ock and made him such an important villain.
Yeah, definitely like up there for like the Spider-Man villain.
Certainly in the last decade. All right, Kevin, before I let you go, I wanted to tell you, because I've been dying to tell you, about my trip to the Albany Comic Book Show last week. You know, it's like semi-annually. Locally here in Albany, they have a kind of an old school hotel ballroom sized con that has some good creators because of kind of who was around from that Catskill crowd. And they always have a surprise guest or two as well.
Yeah, well, way bigger than the one I went to, little con I went to. So
this time around, we had Joe Staton, Joe Jusko, Joe Sinnott, Joe Hembeck. No, just kidding. Fred Hembeck, Mark DeMatteis, sculptor Paul Harding, first timer Tom Fowler.
What?
Yeah. You,
that's big right there. That's big.
How cool is that?
Yeah.
I saw his name on the list. I was thinking that's not a name I usually see. So I shot him a message on Twitter. I'm like, are you really coming down to Albany for this show? And he's up in Montreal.
You're crossing the border. You're really coming to see me? he's one of those guests that I talk about, like legendary.
I mean, this is like a 6 or 7 hour one day show. So for creators to travel to it, it is asking a lot in some ways, unless they have friends in the area or that sort of thing, or they want to come and hang out with Joe Sinnott. I mean, this is where you got to go if you want to hang out with Joe Sinnott. So that was cool. So I, with Tom coming down, when there's someone who is doesn't frequent the show often or it's their first time, it's a great opportunity because I get spoiled by these getting to catch up with the same creators and picking art up from them. So with Tom coming down, I kind of prearranged a commission from him. Mm. And when I got to the con, I call it a con loosely. I think of it more as like a card show sized, like it's a comic book show is what it is. It's appropriately titled. But when I got to the show, I see Paul Harding, who I'm friendly with, coming in, and he's walking in with Tom. And Tom says, I've got that Deathlok for you. And I was like, oh. And Harding says, that Deathlok is yours? And I'm like,
that's probably the same reaction I had when, because I think Tom had posted it.
Yes.
And then I was just like, well, that would be cool if you got something like that. But I'm thinking, no, what are the odds, right? I'm thinking maybe, but it looks exceptional. So I'm like, I don't know if you're like, I know his rates are much higher than when I commissioned something from him.
I mean, Fowler said to me, you haven't seen it yet. And I was like, no, I haven't seen it yet. I wasn't even sure you were going to have time to do it. He's like, oh, I did it. And it's been on social media and everyone seems to love it.
This is the thing. It was making the rounds already.
And Harding knows I love Deathlok because he was working on a piece for Rich Buckler's wife's auction at the last Albany show. When he was hanging out sort of in between doing stuff for people at the show. So it was just really funny. And he's like, I'm so glad you're getting that, you know, Paul's saying. And when I did finally see it, oh my goodness, what a piece it was. And like you say, rate-wise, it's the most expensive piece I've ever purchased. But I'm a cheapskate. I've never paid more than like $120 for a piece before. Okay, so it's not saying much to say it's the most expensive, but
no, it looks worth it. Like the most expensive though.
it's like a cover quality color piece of gouache and ink. It's hot. It's the hotness. Then, I mean, Joe just goes there, right? And for a small show like this, I don't think he's going to be doing any drawing because he usually takes his time and likes to do things like not in between greeting fans and stuff. But with the size of the show too, there was times where he was kind of hanging out. He's got all his prints of the corner box recreations.
That's what I was thinking. Oh, he had all that stuff come out recently. Yeah.
They're gorgeous. They're so cool. I got a handful of them.
And I probably should have got some of the comics, but I probably should have got one of the other, you know, big full size.
Yeah, they're amazing. And they're on this nice cardstocky paper too. They're real nice prints. But I see him sketching and I'm like, Joe, are you sketching today? I didn't think that you would be at a short show like this. And he's like, I didn't think I would be either, but you know, guy asked and I was like, all right. And I was like, you don't have room to do another one, do you? You know? And he's like, I'm not sure if I will. And I'm like, no, dude, no worries. And he's like, no, you know, I could probably fit you in. And I'm like, I don't want to do that to you, pressure you. I've talked to Jusko several times and quite fond of how he interacts with fans as well as being fond of his work. But he's like, no worries. On the spot, I went to a dollar box and grabbed a Fantastic Four and asked them to do an Invisible Girl, and he knocked it out of the park. Did a really nice pen and ink Invisible Girl. Then Joe Sinnott, our friend Jerry McDade, had given me in Baltimore his artist's edition of the Marvel covers, in which he's been getting signatures from artists whose work appear inside. And he's got some big names on there, Steranko and Sienkiewicz and the like. And he wanted to get Joe Sinnott's autograph. And you got to go to the Albany show if you want to see Joe Sinnott. That's just the deal. I facilitated that for him. And that was cool because Joe had fun trying to identify all of the other signatures, you know. And including Rib Jerry through me by saying, where's Stan's signature here? Stan's not anywhere. But then for me, I brought him my twice up Fantastic Four Artist Edition. And I was not sure if he was going to be drawing anything. He brought a few pre-drawn things on index cards. But, you know, he's retired from doing commissions and, you know, sometimes that shows if he feels like he can do a few, he'll do a few, but depends on what his stamina is like, you know? Depends on how he's feeling. But for the big artist edition like that, he was happy to draw something in it and to increase the chance of him accepting the challenge of drawing something in this enormous book. I tried to pick something easy. I've got a Doom from him. I've got a Thing from him. You know, I've got a Namor from him. So I was trying to think of something different to go in the artist edition, but I also wanted to make it pretty easy so he could, you know, wouldn't mind whipping it out. So I asked for a Black Bolt. And boy, he started doing that Black Bolt. And this book is so enormous, Kevin. You can't turn it on a table. You can barely fit it on a table. It's almost a table itself.
I was going to ask you, like, did you have a cart? Like, did you go somewhere? Like, meaning you brought the book with you, went somewhere, and like returned and got rid of it like right away after?
Exactly. This is a small show that's 20 minutes from my house. I ran it out to the car. I brought Jerry's book back to the car, and I grabbed my book and brought it. You know, just 2 minute walk to the car.
Because I can't imagine carrying those things. Like, that's
No. I don't do that to big cons, but because this is right this is in my backyard, there's no way.
Yeah.
And Joe's there, and to get him to sketch something in the actual artist edition is just too good of an opportunity to pass up. So he is not steady on his feet anymore, but he is still has a real steady hand. I'm happy to be able to report. But it was so cool because he couldn't turn it on the table, but he wanted to get his preferred angle of attack, you know, to do the sketch. He gets up and he starts moving around the book. And he's walking around to the side of the table and leaning over. He's in the front of the table and leaning over. And pretty soon, the other talent start getting up from their tables and start coming over. Joe Jusko kind of leading the pack, and everyone's taking pictures of Joe standing over this enormous book, sketching this black bolt, and everyone's talking to each other, and Jusko starts talking to Sinnott, and then they start flipping through the artist edition, and Jusko's like interviewing Sinnott on all of our behalfs about the book, flipping through, looking at pages, talking about the pages. Sinnott said that he used to ink two, sometimes three, but usually like two and a half Kirby pages a day. At that size.
That's crazy.
Incredible. And they talked about Sinnott's signature rubble and the way that he would, you know, do Kirby tech and ink stuff. It was just so cool. So cool.
You're just like, I can't believe a panel has like broken out like all of a sudden.
Yeah, over my book, you know? Yeah,
exactly.
A lot of fun. I had Fred Hembeck draw a spy versus spy. I thought that would be a fun subject for him to attack. Paul Harding drew a deathlock for me. Like I said, I had seen him do that one for Rich Buckler's auction last year, so I wanted one for myself. And I should add, too, that he was with the Ominous Press.
Oh, okay.
Booth, so to speak. You know, that's Bart Sears's and Ron Mars's group, and they've got a Kickstarter campaign for an OGN right now, Beasts of the Black Hand. You could check that out if you want to see something a little different, a little horror noir kind of stuff. And I got Nizar the Calculator, one of Kirby Celestials, drawn on my Celestials Jam by Richard Clark. He's got to be the kookiest Kirby design, especially the Celestials. He's got like a clown face almost, but Clark managed to do it in a way that really paid homage to the initial design but didn't make him look goofy, which is a hard one to pull off. And I started a new jam piece of Tolkien characters. I love Tolkien. I don't know what you think of the Lord of the Rings stuff, but when I was a youth, like in kindergarten, my dad used to read The Hobbit to me like every night before bed. And then as soon as I could read myself solidly, I read the rest of Lord of the Rings and revisited them all again as teens and then, you know, again as adults with the movies and stuff. But yeah, I've always loved that stuff.
I don't know if you heard the news, but apparently Amazon's trying to make like a TV series.
Yeah, it's weird.
So I was just like, okay, I get, like, if you want to mine other material from like other related stuff, like I it seems like there's enough there, but that's weird.
Yeah, there's so much history that happened before The Hobbit, you know, that they could easily do different types of stories from like Elrond's days or Sméagol finding the ring, you know, and slowly becoming Gollum. I mean, there's so many things they could do. But
they'll call it before Lord of the Rings, you know, like before watching.
Yeah, exactly. It is Warner Brothers, right? So maybe they will go that route.
You don't want to do the after. You only want to do the before.
So in a jam for the Lord of the Rings, the first square is always an important one to set the bar, right, for the jam piece. Well, an artist who attends the Albany show frequently, who is quite established in doing, like, trading card sketch cards and stuff, Christian St. Pierre, who drew a great 70s, like, Bronze Age Ghost Rider for me a few years ago on my Bronze Age Marvel jam. He draws great skeletons and demons and armored creatures and stuff, so I had him draw the Nazgul, you know, one of the Dark Riders, and oh my gosh, he was at this all day, this square. I mean, I should have paid him five times what he charged me because of the amount of time and effort he put into this thing, but wait till you see. I'll post it on the Marvel Noise thread on Facebook and on the Twitter feed as well. It's incredible. Really cool. So a good start for that. But I was like, it was an Albany show that I almost, I mean, I got pieces equivalent to going to one of the big cons. I came away with a bigger haul than ever before.
Yeah, I was going to say, does this sound like one of the like the greatest? But then you've had a lot of great hauls, so.
I've had Starlin there. You know, yeah. And Terry Austin and folks like that have made shows special in different ways. But this was really cool. Got some good stuff. That Deathlock from Fowler. It's my new wallpaper on my iPad. Mm. All right, dude. Thanks for joining me. And while Andrew's trying to find evidence of the Mandarin's rings...
That's right. That's why he went there, right?
On assignment to find that last ring.
He just needs to see some alien Mandarin spaceship or something related, right?
In search of Fin Fang Foom.
You got to it before I did. He's going to be swinging that Great Wall of China around.
It would hold together. It really would. You could crack it like a whip.
Oh jeez!
Next time we'll have Andrew back, and we'll do the Thunderbolts and more good stuff, right?
I think so.
Sounds good. All right, stick around. I think I'm going to come back and talk about the Deadpool minis from the last couple of years. They always have a Deadpool mini running at the same time as the regular series, and usually one runs at a time. But you get like two or three a year. So
yeah.
I just caught up on 2016 and up to date with the recent ones.
Deadpool probably killed someone, I'm guessing.
In taking a look at the last half dozen Deadpool limited series from the last couple of years, 2016 and 2017, we start with 2016's Deadpool v. Gambit, which ran five issues written by Ben Acker and Ben Blacker with art by Danilo Bayruth. This one was a surprise treat. The art is pretty stylized, but ends up fitting with the tone quite nicely. It's a buddy book. Don't let the V fool you. Deadpool and Gambit are portrayed here operating as a duo of con men. They're running cons, conning people for money, con. They start out, for instance, on a caper where they're impersonating Spider-Man and Daredevil, meeting each other. They're even state out loud that they're having the obligatory pre-team-up fight between heroes, and they really crash around and destroy property and like going through windows and messing up infrastructure and stuff. It begins the ruckus in a museum. And after the whole battle, they reveal that they robbed the place while passing through, like, in the commotion. The dialogue is really funny along the way, too. So they're actually working with a third guy who then cons them. It's all about the con. And then later recruits Deadpool and Gambit for one more big job, which is to steal an artifact. Well, the artifact turns out to belong to this big dude that is later revealed to be the immortal weapon, Fat Cobra. They totally satirize the Brubaker Fraction Kung Fu move labels, like across panels, with ones like the Burning Wok Strike or the Tantric Nostril Destruction, the Uppercut of the Quiet Stream, things like that. Gambit's powers along the way get so scrambled up that he ends up sort of like Rogue. If he touches someone, he wrecks them by kinetically charging them, blows this girl's hand off unintentionally. In issue 4, he charges up Deadpool, who then takes on an Iron Fist parody persona. And then in the last issue, the Warriors 3 from Asgard even show up. Like I said, a surprise treat this one was. Also in 2016 was Deadpool Back in Black. It was a sequel to 2015's Deadpool Secret War, where Deadpool was kind of inserted into the 80s Secret Wars event, like, you know, between the panels, helping move things along like he was there all along. This is by Cullen Bunn and Salva Espin. So this 5-issue series takes place after Spidey rejects the symbiote suit that he brought back from Battleworld, but before the suit merges with Eddie Brock and becomes Venom. The deal is that there's a space bounty hunter named Killer Thrill that's after the Clintar symbiote. So the symbiote bonds with Deadpool, who is known to him from the Secret War series, and, you know, takes a defensive posture. The first issue guest stars the classic Kirby Ditko era Machine Man, which is cool. The second issue is a power pack team up, even with Obnoxio the Clown, that crazy magazine mascot from the 80s. The third issue has the Black Cat coming on to Black Spider Deadpool because he's, you know, giving off all the right vibes, right? But then the two of them together break up an operation that's being carried out by the White Rabbit, and it all gets intercepted by the Killer Thrill bounty hunter and her team. Issue 4 ends up being the best of the bunch, with Kraven the Hunter taking on this Venom Pool thing. He thinks he's Spider-Man, so, I mean, it's a riot. In the big final battle, Deadpool basically tells him in the end that, like, Kraven, you're predictable, and if you want to catch Spidey, you gotta catch him off balance. Try something different next time, like a gun. So Kraven goes off at the end ranting about this visitation from this spider-like totem and decides he must become the spider just in time for Kraven's last hunt. The last issue, number 5, has the bounty hunter chick taking down the real Spider-Man, who was then wearing a black non-symbiote costume, thinking that it was the symbiote, and Deadpool has to save Spidey and the symbiote and help get all the pieces into place for Amazing Spider-Man 299 and 300 when Venom makes his first appearance, which he does. The next limited series, also 2016, was Deadpool the Duck. Our own Andrew the LA Rabbit spoke somewhat positively about the first issue some episodes back, but I passed on this one. Enough said. 2017 started with the 5-issue Deadpool vs. the Punisher limited series written by Fred Van Lente with art by Pierre Perez. This one has the Punisher on the trail of The Bank, who's a guy who, like, manages all the accounts of various mobsters. But also Deadpool. I mean, Deadpool's known him for years and years. Like, The Bank's kid even calls Deadpool Uncle Wade and stuff. So Deadpool ends up protecting The Bank from the Frank. The Bank's wife and their son flee, but they're being chased because the boy is, like, savantish, and he's got, like, all this number knowledge and has all the bank account numbers in his head, like he's the backup. So a bunch of mobsters and assassins get added to the mix. They want their money from the bank. They want to know that their accounts are protected, etc. The Taskmaster makes the scene as one of these assassins and is portrayed quite evil in this one, even though I think it was Fred Van Lente who wrote a Taskmaster limited series that portrayed him quite differently and somewhat sympathetically. This series, though, it's violent, fast-paced, and but overall really entertaining, I thought. 2017 also has Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe again. 5 issues with a parental advisory, as on most of these limited series. Also written by Cullen Bunn, this one has art by Dalibor Talajek and Goran Sadzuka. Deadpool is systematically, like, working his way through the Marvel Universe, killing heroes one by one. Now, he thinks he's having grand adventures and team-ups with these heroes, and is oblivious to the fact that he's murdering them. Jessica Jones, Misty Knight, the Punisher, Cable, the Kate Bishop Hawkeye, and Mr. Knight, Moon Knight, are on his trail. They're trying to piece together the clues, first to find out that it's Deadpool, then to figure out that he's not doing this of his free will. Of course, there's some big bads behind it, and it's a whole cabal of villains, the Red Skull with the Abomination, Magneto, and Doctor Doom. So, like, for instance, Deadpool imagines he's adventuring with Spider-Man while wearing the Back in Black costume symbiote, and they have to out-eat the Blob for charity at this charity event. And in reality, Deadpool has killed Eddie Brock, he's wearing the Venom symbiote, and he's helping the Venom symbiote fulfill his, you know, one of his bucket list goals, which is to eat Spider-Man's brain. So while he thinks he's stuffing himself for charity, he's, you know, yeah. Gwenpool actually plays a pivotal part in this series. She gets intel, and the heroes rally in the third ish. They get met, though, by Deadpool as Ultron, thanks to the Mad Thinker and Arnim Zola, and it's a massacre. Gwenpool also helps Wade break free of his conditioning, and then in the last issue, he goes about killing all the villains, including a final smackdown with the Skull. It's a pretty good what-if-type tale. And currently being published is Deadpool vs. Old Man Logan, written by Declan Shalvey, with art by Mike Henderson. The Mike Henderson art is so good that you don't really miss that Declan Shalvey is the writer and not the artist. In the first issue, Deadpool and Old Man Logan meet on the subway, and they fight in the park, and then get inadvertently mixed up in some militia's plot to capture some chick who's got powers. I guess we'll see where this one goes. All right, that's it for the last batch of Deadpool Limited series, and that's it for this episode of Marvel Noise. Thanks, everybody, for tolerating the kooky release schedule of late. Totally due to me getting behind on reading and editing due to my neurovestibular impairment. I'm wiped out in the evening. I usually get like a headache behind my eyes, and I'm not productive at the times where I would have previously been really indulging in all of my hobbies and interests and reading and all that good stuff. On top of that, this episode I also am coming off of a cold, which I got enough things in my head without being congested as well. Anyhow, with that in mind, until Moon Knight's foe Morpheus is determined to be behind it all, make mine Marvel. Later.